It is so good to be in Oregon. It is so great to be home, and I truly feel like it is home here in Portland again, and it's good to see so many faces, and I've already seen many that I've come to know and love over the years. I never feel, I think, more at home than I do when I'm in Oregon, and many of you know that I want, and I will, I promise you, I will be a resident of this great state sometime in the very near future. To use a phrase that's common in cop talk, when the shit hits the fan, there's nobody I'd rather be with than you guys. So, and boy, is that the truth. You know, the world has changed a lot, and I absolutely want to thank the best radio station in the entire United States of America, Cable, for all their wonderful support. And the Courage and the 9/11 Truth Alliance and everybody who's had anything to do with this. I see my friend Per sitting right down here in front, and I remember pushing your Volkswagen bus around the city a few years ago when you broke down, and you know, there's just so many people here, my friend Lisa and everybody else. So anyway, I'm happy to be here. We have a lot to talk about tonight. We have a lot of work to do. Things are happening, in case you hadn't noticed, really quickly, really fast. The world is changing so fast it's hard to keep up with, but that's what we must do, that's what our purpose must be about, and for those of you who are really, 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 really interested in 9/11, I promise you I will talk about it, but not right up front. I will get there in the end, because there are other things that to me are more pressing, and I'm going to talk about what some of those things are. What you see on the screen here is a copy of my book, Crossing the Rubicon. Can I ask, by show of hands, how many people have read the book? Oh, my God. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. That's wonderful. Because, as you know, it's a book you can easily read overnight. And, it's available outside on our table, which is out front in the lobby near the men's room. We have a lot of other products out there, but there's a lot of other great tables out there, and we encourage you to go out there. Because one of the things that has become a very important mission for me as I have traveled this path through the wilderness over the many years now is to teach activists that there's no sin in making a living changing the world. There's no sin in being able to eat and pay your rent and go to sleep at night without worrying if the power is going to be shut off tomorrow, because activists who eat and who get sleep and who have a place to live and who know that they can pay their, put gasoline in their car for however long we have it, tend to do much better work than activists who are starving, hungry, and poor. It's the Rockefellers who have sold activists on the notion that you need to be poor, and that's for the precise purpose of making you ineffective. I made a promise here in Portland on November, it was actually November 28th of 2001 when I spoke at Portland State University. And the promise that I made was, if you keep buying my newsletters and if you keep buying my products and subscribing, I promise you that I will keep funneling that money back to activists, and I have kept that promise. I'm still living in a single apartment. That may change soon, but just because it has to. I haven't got room to store all the stuff I got anymore. I'm assuming no one will hold me at fault if I get one bedroom, but the point is this, is that for those of you who subscribe to From the Wilderness, how many subscribers to FTW do we have here tonight? Well, that we have to change. Because those of you who do subscribe to FTW know that FTW supports some really incredible writers like Stan Goff, retired U.S. Army Special Forces, Jamie Hecht, Michael Caine, Dale Allen Pfeiffer, and these are all people who now pay their rent and do their job as activist writers and researchers full time because they get paid to do it because that's what they love to do. And as we feed that money back, we work money the same way the Rockefellers do and the Bushes do and everybody else, is because we keep our people fed and they become more productive. And that's the lesson we all need to learn, is how to use our money. We have learned from the 2000 election, we have learned from the 2004 election that every vote may not always be counted. But I promise you that every dollar is always counted, and you got to watch where and how you spend your money, because that's a vote every time you spend a buck. So spend it on the people who give you energy and who help to make this a better world. And that's my end of that sermon for that. How many people here have heard of peak oil? Peak oil. How many people believe that peak oil is real? Okay. How many people believe that peak oil is a sham, a hoax, a horrible, that there's a limitless supply of abiotic oil in the ground that we can go on consuming and growing and it won't harm the planet or anything else? Anybody want to raise their hand for that? There's one in the back. Okay, well, we'll deal with you at the end of the show. But let me just make this point. Whether you believe that peak oil is real or not, you must admit that the world is behaving as if peak oil were real. Am I right? Yeah. So, that's the world that we live in. I'm a realist. I'm a guy who works. My whole philosophy is I don't care about platitudes. I don't rock myself to sleep at night saying I could have tried something, or at least I gave it my heart, or I could have done something. I've watched progressives do that for 30 or 40 years. God bless every progressive or activist or lefty, whatever you want to call yourself in the audience, for all the decades you have put into your activism. But you must admit that over the past 30 or 40 years, the world has done nothing but get worse. Am I right?
Yes.
Okay, now being a practical guy, I mean, I'm an ex-policeman. I used to work on the street. I've been shot. You know, I've been in life and death situations. So for me, some things are cut and dried. If something doesn't work, you try something else. That makes sense? To rephrase that from a lot of spiritual paths, insanity is repeating the same actions over and over again, expecting different results. We are at a time of great crisis, not only a crisis for the United States of America, but a crisis for the entire planet, the human race, the planet itself, all life on the planet, and what kind of a future is going to be left for those younger than us who are going to follow us. And for anybody in this room who's in their 20s and 30s, on behalf of my generation, I apologize, because my generation really screwed things up. I do. So we're going to talk about what's going on and what's real, because there have been some fundamental changes in my approach. And I've got almost 30 years of doing what I do. I've got 30 years of experience in what works and what doesn't work. And that's part of what I want to share with you tonight, because I do not want you guys to leave here less equipped to deal with what's coming. I want you guys to leave here more equipped to deal with what's coming. That's 9/11. One of the greatest crimes in world history. It has run us over. It was a monstrous, monumental, horrendous crime. It was cold-blooded, premeditated mass murder. But it's run us over, and that elephant, having just run us over, is walking away. On the other hand, there is a herd of angry elephants that happens to be charging at us right now in the form of peak oil, in the form of economic collapse, in the form of climate collapse, in the form of fascist totalitarianism, pending world conflict, and a whole bunch of other things which we're going to talk about tonight. They call me Mr. Cheery because I always depress everybody so much that, you know, people usually get really stoned when they leave one of my events. Nobody in Oregon gets stoned, do they? I thought so. Well, tonight I'm going to give you little pieces of good news along the way. I've learned my lesson. To me, it's more important to worry about the danger that's coming rather than the one that's just passed. I've seen people die in the street. I've had to make decisions, and I've been in that environment. I was trained in that environment. So I'm more concerned about saving lives for what danger is coming than addressing wrongs that we may never have a chance. I mean, we are now, it's 2005, right? So we are now 42 years after the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, and people are still demanding justice, and they're still debating acoustic audio tapes and photographic evidence from Dealey Plaza, and what effect does that have on the world right now? The only thing that matters to me is change in the political and economic landscape. And failing that, the only thing that matters to me is saving human life, period. That's how my success or failure is measured. And that's all I care about. And when I go to sleep at night, that's all I think about. I want you guys to kind of trust what I tell you. If you know me or if you've looked at our writings at FTW, you know that we never present anything to you that is not fully sourced. If you've read Crossing the Rubicon, you've seen the 1,000 footnotes at the end of the book. I don't ask you to take anything at face value. I say, here's what I say, and here's the proof for what I say. But I want to show you just a couple of places where we've been right, because over our history now, which is 7.5+ years, we've batted about 800 in terms of our predictions and our analysis. Now, Ted Williams only had to bat 400, as Catherine Austin Fitz says, and he was the best guy that ever stepped up to the plate. We batted about 800. It's not because I'm a genius. It's not because God talks to me. He's too busy talking to George W. Bush. I do try to listen to God whenever I can. I'm not always sure that I hear right, but my ears are always open. It's because we have a map. And if you have a map of what's going on and what direction you're going, you can generally tell what the next feature on the landscape is going to be. Some 5 years ago, this is in 2000, January 2000, I wrote a story about a guy named Edwin Wilson. How many people know who Edwin Wilson is? Edwin Wilson, in the 1970s, was a protege of the CIA's Associate Deputy Director of Operations, Ted Shackley, a very dirty covert operative with a long history. And in 1976, Ed Wilson was charged with selling, I think, some huge amount. I think it was like 100,000 pounds of C4 plastic explosive to Muammar Gaddafi. Ed Wilson and his partner, Frank Turple, both were CIA guys, and the story was that Wilson left the CIA and he was acting on his own, was rogue, etc., etc. 5 years ago, I obtained court records and a perjured CIA affidavit that was used to convict Edwin Wilson and sentence him to multiple life terms in federal prison. There was evidence in the legal records that showed that the CIA knew that they were using a perjured affidavit to get the conviction, saying that he had left the CIA's employ and had no more contacts with them. And in that entire story, I laid out the reasons why I knew that Ed Wilson would someday be released from prison. Just a month ago, this is from April 28, 2005, ABC News, the most dangerous man in America, conviction of former CIA agent overturned on false affidavit. I was 5 years ahead of that. Ed Wilson is now a free man. He's not a great guy, he's not a wonderful guy, but he was wrongly convicted for what sent him to prison. And we told you about that 5 years in advance. In another story, right before 9/11, probably one of the deepest investigative stories that I had ever worked on, I had started what was going to be a three-part series on the American International Group. That's the largest insurance company in the world. To put that in perspective, they control literally hundreds of billions of dollars in cash flow on a daily basis. They also launder drug money, because I had become aware that a woman by the name of Coral Marie Talavera Baca was also the wife of a man by the name of Carlos Lader, L-E-H-D-E-R. How many people know who Carlos Lader was? Carlos Lader was one of the three co-founders of the Medellin cartel of the 1980s. And she was an active employee at the world's largest insurance company's offices in San Francisco. I actually had lunch with her in the summer of 2001. And I outlined how they were using offshore companies in the Caribbean to cook their books, to launder drug profits. And now we see, this is a story from 2001, just this year, Elliot Spitzer, the Attorney General of New York, has filed a suit against the CEO of AIG, Hank Greenberg, for cooking the books, committing a number of crimes. And one of the guys I interviewed, Michael Murphy, has been relieved from duty, and he's about to be indicted on the same charges. Not too long ago, I got a call, just a couple weeks ago, from the Wall Street Journal. You can barely see it. Details emerged on obscure Barbados reinsurer tied to AIG, Wall Street Journal, May 12th. And the Wall Street Journal reporter had been going through my site, and he asked for evidence that I had, which I sent him. And then he said, my God, you nailed this 5 years ago. And then he alluded to me. He didn't confirm it. He suggested to me that Hank Greenberg himself, the CEO of America's largest insurance company, the world's largest insurance company, was actually having an affair with the wife of the co-founder of the Medellin cartel.
Now, that's just an anecdotal piece of information, but then how many of you believe that Wall Street and what major corporations tell you can be trusted? No hands. Not even the guy who doesn't believe in peak oil. That's good. Okay. In October of 2002, and in every one of the lectures I have now given in 10 countries since 9/11, I have said very clearly one thing about Iraq. Amid repeated stories that the U.S. intends to balkanize the region, splitting Iraq and possibly Saudi Arabia into several kingdoms divided between Hashemite, Sunni Arab, Kurdish, and Shiite ethnic groups, tensions between Muslim countries in the regions have been steadily mounting. U.S. intends to balkanize the region. I've always said for years now that the U.S. intends to carve up Iraq into 5 or 6 states. Why? Because if you want to control the oil, you only have to control a tiny sliver of land in Iraq. And here's a story just from May 29th, 2005. I was putting these slides together right before we hit the road. U.S. lays plans to make Iraq a federation of 6 states. That way we can pull out of the others and just control the ones where the oil is. So I would submit to you, and that's just 3 examples of many, many examples at FTW where I and our great writers and our great staff and the minds that we have assembled the map, we read the map, and we've made predictions, and we've been right on the money. I want you to pay attention to what I'm telling you tonight for that reason. This is from the Associated Press on May 24th, 2005. The Associated Press. When a story hits the AP, it's mainstream, it's out of the closet. Global energy crunch. Oil peak predicted. And they talk about this thing called peak oil, and we've come a long way since I first started talking about peak oil. It's pretty much out of the closet everywhere. And peak oil is the most significant event to hit mankind in the history of human civilization. And I have 5 rules, which we will illuminate for you tonight, on how we approach, or what I think is the best way to deal with peak oil. And what I'm not alone in this. There's a great many thinkers like Colin Campbell, Richard Heinberg. How many people have read books by Richard Heinberg? The Party's Over, Power Down. You must get those books. We sell those off our website. Richard Heinberg is a professor at New College down in Northern California. A very dear friend of mine, and he and I are on the same page. As a great many thinkers have come to the same conclusions. One, there is no combination of alternative energy sources anywhere that will enable current consumption and growth to continue. Period. 2, even if there were, it takes 30 years and lots of capital investment to change an energy infrastructure. Peak oil is here now. Professor David Goodstein, the Vice Chancellor of the California Institute of Technology, has laid it out very clearly in a book he published last year. It takes 30 years to rewire an infrastructure to handle a new form of energy. And lots and lots and lots and lots of money. In case you haven't noticed, the United States doesn't have lots and lots and lots of money anymore because we're spending it conquering and blowing up the rest of the world and sucking it out of your pension funds. 3, no government entity, federal or state, I'm excluding local, will do or be able to do anything to solve peak oil and energy shortages. The political system is broken. Disabuse yourself from any notion that you're going to walk out of this room and you're going to start writing petitions to a member of Congress somewhere to get him to do something, to try to pass some legislation, to change something about peak oil, because you're all going to be dead by the time anything happens anyway. How successful have you been at getting Congress to do anything for all these years? The political system is broken. Until you change the way money works, you change nothing. Burn that into your consciousness. Until you change the way money works, you change nothing. Thank you. Somebody gets it. It will be more profitable to let decline, starvation, wars, disease, and famine occur than it will be to prevent them. We call this disaster capitalism. We'll come to that later in the presentation. All real solutions will be place-based, local, and originate at the grassroots, independent of government. What saves you will be determined by what and who is in your own neighborhood and what kind of cooperation has been achieved there. period. Let's do a brief rundown on peak oil. All oil production. I scared you already. I'm sorry. All oil production, whether it's in one oil field, one country, or one planet, always follows a bell curve. Always. Everybody's seen the movie Giant, or all us old people have, you know, with Rock Hudson and James Dean. They drill the well, and it gushes up, and they're bathing in oil. That's the first well right here, where the oil is near the surface and under pressure. So you drill more wells, and your production goes up as you get more wells online. Eventually, you reach a peak when you've extracted half of the oil in the field, and you keep drilling more wells, but the level keeps going down and down and down, so you always come down the curve. Keep drilling more wells does not mean more production. Once you reach this peak, no matter how much money or technology you throw at the problem, you cannot produce more oil. The guy who really brought this concept to world attention truly was a prophet. His name was M. King Hubbard. In 1956, as a shell geologist, he predicted, based upon this theory and his mathematical calculations, that United States oil production would peak in 1970. He was crucified, excoriated, called names. He was vilified, made fun of. I know how all that feels, personally. But he was right. U.S. oil production did peak in 1970. And so we call it now Hubbard's peak in recognition of the contribution he made. And by the way, Hubbard, in his own original monograph, had a paragraph in there where he said, until you change the way money works, you will not be able to solve the problems of peak oil. Isn't that amazing? If you take a dollar bill out of your wallet, or a 20 or a 100 or whatever, and you look at it, what does it represent? Money represents the ability to do work. Right? Energy is the ability to do work. If I want to take a dollar bill, I can go buy gasoline. That's energy. I can hire someone to clean my house. That's the expenditure of human energy. I can hire someone to cook. I can buy an appliance, which was made with energy and uses energy. You spend dollars to get energy to work for you. If there is no energy, money ultimately becomes valueless. Especially the kind of money we have, which is fiat currency. And that's part of the solutions we'll get to towards the end of this. But Hubbard's peak was very clear. Hydrocarbon production would eventually peak. He was saying it would peak somewhere around 2010. But you see these lines here represent the actual graph of human consumption based upon his projection. And you see everything is skewed time-wise back to the left. So the peak would occur around 2000. Between 2000 and 2004. Personally, I am convinced we are at peak right now, plus or minus 6 months. Plus or minus 6 months. And we'll cover that later on. Hydrocarbon production per capita is the black line. In actuality, on this planet, hydrocarbon production per capita, that's oil, natural gas, and coal, peaked in 1979. Per capita hydrocarbon production has already started into decline. But what you see is population growth overshoot. And here we have to thank the real heroes of the peak oil movement, Jay Hansen, and people like the wonderful, brilliant Richard Duncan of Eugene, Oregon, and his partner Walter Youngquist, who really started to look into the issues of population overshoot and to understand what that was going to mean. And we're going to see that Dick Cheney is very familiar with that concept before I'm done tonight. And everybody he represents. So the problem is the population overshoot because, as we all know, maybe we all don't know, demand for hydrocarbons, especially oil, is still exploding exponentially across the planet. Am I right? You all aware of that? Especially from this little country called China? Not to mention here, we, the United States, are 5% of the world's population, consuming 25% of the world's energy. This is a graph of human population over the years. Zero anno domini, from the time of Christ, population was fairly stable at around 2 billion people on the planet. This little dip right here is the bubonic plague. Okay. So then they started burning wood and discovered steam, then they discovered coal, then they discovered oil. And all of this population growth is a direct result of oil. Why? Because oil has energy density which cannot be matched by anything else on the planet. We'll talk about nuclear in a second. But to give you a rough comparison, a University of California study concluded, as have many others, that it takes 1,113 gallons of gaseous hydrogen to give you the same energy of 1 gallon of gasoline. Now, hydrogen is an absolute chimera. It's a joke. There will be no solution from hydrogen anywhere, under any circumstances. EV Magazine just about 6 months ago published a story saying fuel cell engines, hydrogen fuel cell engines, have a life expectancy of 200 hours. Now, would you buy a hydrogen fuel cell car if you knew that every 200 hours of use you had to buy a new engine for it? They aren't telling you that, are they? In the meantime, the governor from my screwed-up state, Arnold Schwarzenegger, says, we build a hydrogen highway. Yeah, you come, we have gas stations, we pump you up, yeah? You know? Sure, you know? Hydrogen is a joke. But there are 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy in every calorie of food produced on the planet. 10. Why? How do we grow food? Well, first we drive an oil-powered machine along the field to plow the field. Then we drive an oil-powered machine along the field to plant the seeds. And we plant the seeds. Now we have to irrigate it. Well, how do we irrigate it? We irrigate with electric pumps. Where does the electricity come from? We burn oil and natural gas, or coal, and about 12% of the power in this country is hydroelectric, but that's dwindling. Okay, so you got to burn hydrocarbons to irrigate it. Then you got to spray it with pesticides. What are all commercial pesticides made from? Oil. Then you got to fertilize it. And what are all commercial agribusiness, corporate frankenfood, screwed up, globalized, messed up corporate food fertilizers made from?
Oil.
Natural gas. Same thing. Then you want to harvest it. What do you got to do? You got to drive the harvester along, which is powered by oil. Then you got to drive it back to the food processing plant, which runs on electricity. They process with chemicals. And then they package it in plastic, which is also oil. They drive it by another oil-powered vehicle to your supermarket, where you drive an oil-powered vehicle. And then you whip out a piece of plastic, a piece of oil, and you pay for it, and you take it home, and you put it on a plastic plate, and you eat it. That 10 calories didn't count cooking energy. 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy for every calorie of food on the planet. This is a graph made by a British guy named Norman Church. We published a whole brilliant article on this, where he talks about the insanity of current world food production. I was down in Eugene, 2 days ago? I don't remember when it was. Mark, 2 days ago? 3 days ago? And I found out that, like, all the cropland around here, they're growing grass seed to sell the grass seed to China. Okay, but that's okay. I live in Los Angeles. Southern California has the best strawberry fields in the world, that I can go to a supermarket and the strawberries come from Chile. 10,000-mile Caesar salads. They mine tin and aluminum in Australia and send it to Norway to Holland to make tin cans, send it to Norway to fill it with sardines and send it back to Britain where it gets wrapped so they can come back and sell the same sardines back in American supermarkets. Globalization is dead with peak oil. D-E-D, dead. Just seeing if you're paying attention. 70% of all transportation fuel on the planet is oil. Oil is back up at $52, $53 a barrel right now. It's going to be at $100, $105, $200 a barrel within the next 3 years. They won't be able to afford to do that. The problem is, who's going to starve? You are. So globalization, as you conceive of it, is over. They can't afford to be moving all this stuff all around the world. Okay, now some of you are saying, well, there's always more oil to find. They're hiding oil in Alaska. That's a good one. I heard that one a lot. They're hiding oil in Alaska. Okay, we'll deal with that in a second. Global oil discoveries peaked in 1962. And one of the things Hubbard said very clearly was the peak of production usually occurs about 40 years after the peak in discovery. J. just for the record, in the years 2003 and 2004, there was not on the planet anywhere a single discovery anywhere of a so-called mega field of 500 million barrels. Now, let me put that in perspective for you. The world uses 1 billion barrels of oil every 11 and one-half days. That means in 2003 and 2004, they didn't even find one field with a six-day supply of oil. It takes 3 to 5 years to bring one of those fields online. 3 to 5 years. I mean, you got one well, you got to drill other wells, you got to put in the infrastructure, the pumps, the piping. There's all kinds of stuff that has to happen. And oil companies report this. Why? Because their stock goes up when they report discoveries. They have no incentive to hide oil. As a matter of fact, Shell, you know, had to downgrade its reserve estimates 4 times over the last 2 years. They were cooking their books. They were inflating their reserve estimates. Reserves are, you know, that's an actuarial accounting thing. It has nothing to do with geology. Mother Earth laughs at accountants and economists. Really does. Because oil companies, first of all, what they do is, let's say they find a field with 2 billion barrels. If they declare that 2 billion barrel find in 1 year, they have to pay the taxes on 2 billion barrels all in 1 year. The accountants say, no, it's better if we find 500 million barrels this year and 500 this year, then we can spread out the tax payments. But the people who want to say that peak oil isn't real will come up and say, see, they're finding more reserves in the old fields. It's all accounting. That's all it is. You have to backdate the reserve finds. And oil companies also have to keep their stock value up, and if they go multiple years without new finds or new reserves, the stockholders get nervous and the stock price goes down. Until you change the way money works, you change nothing. Zip. This is a story from a great group in Britain. I just came back from England last month, the Oil Depletion Analysis Center. And what they've done is they have gone through all the books everywhere in the world for all the finds and looked at all the fields that are coming online. And they've also looked at how how production is falling off all around the globe. And we know what fields are coming online because it takes 3 to 5 years to bring them online. And it is now an absolute mathematical certainty that by 2007, that's 2 years or less, there are gross shortfalls between supply and demand. The world starts to come unhinged in 2 years or less. Period. All over the world right now, peak oil is hitting. You don't hear about it. We find the stories at FTW, and a lot of other great websites are doing that. Matt Savinar was doing it at his site. There are a couple other sites that are really tracking this, and I'm going to be doing that more with FTW in the near future. Philippines are setting up a 4-day work week. Why? To save energy. China is experiencing massive blackouts. Thailand is experiencing blackouts as a result of shortages. Indonesia, Venezuela, Iran, obviously, about 15-20 countries now are scrambling to go nuclear because they realize that they won't have any electricity if they don't. Of course, nuclear is no silver bullet, believe me. But this stuff is already hitting around the world right now. Under your very noses, and I'm going to read this to you because you might not be able to see it, but just listen to this. China is already consuming or hoarding 60% of the world's commodities, oil, cement, aluminum, copper, zinc, manganese, steel, coal, gold, silver, etc. China, Russia, Iran, Venezuela, India, Brazil, Malaysia, South Africa, Europe, parts of West Africa are forging an economic alliances which exclude the U.S. Tensions between Japan and China are increasing. We'll talk about that. China and Canada have just signed an oil energy pact. China and Canada? I always knew that it was the Canadians who were responsible for everything. It's their fault. Damn Canadians. Yeah. China is experiencing blackouts and threatening to shut down businesses that consume too much energy. South Africa is predicting permanent blackouts by 2010. Wow. Australia and New Zealand are currently experiencing energy shortages and blackouts, very serious in New Zealand and some parts of Australia. Thailand is experiencing blackouts. The UK is experiencing severe energy shortages. The EU has decided to lift its ban on selling arms to China. Texaco's CEO has announced that world oil supply cannot meet demand. Russia has shifted to a basket of currencies emphasizing the euro. Venezuela is buying MiG-29s and Russian missiles, forming a defense pact with Brazil and preparing for a proxy war with Colombia. We'll talk about that. Syria and Iran are receiving Russia and Chinese military assistance. The housing bubble is starting to collapse as legislation to seize and shut down Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is introduced in the Senate. The Fed and Treasury are doing, Fed is the Federal Reserve, and Treasury are doing nothing to discourage consumer debt or budget deficits. The U.S. government, the Treasury, and Federal Reserve are doing nothing to stop these trends. They are betting on China, and most U.S. equity has already moved there or offshore. We'll talk about that in a second. First of all, right now, many of y'all, I'll bet half the people in this audience are saying, why would the Treasury and the Fed be trying to wreck the U.S. economy? Let me ask you a rhetorical question. By a show of hands, how many people believe that the Great Depression hurt the rich people? The Great Depression was a wealth transfer. It didn't destroy wealth, it transferred the wealth. But now peak oil is changing that because wealth will to some degree be destroyed. But all the big rich money, the money that the Bushes and the Cheneys and the Rockefellers has already moved offshore. It will not be hurt by a collapse in the United States. As a matter of fact, they will make money and they will achieve several objectives by crashing the U.S. economy, and you'll see that before I'm through tonight. Much of the U.S. Wealth is moved overseas, manufacturing bases, tool and die, skilled labor, and cash, especially what we now know is in excess of $5 trillion with a T dollars stolen from the United States Treasury. How many people are familiar with Catherine Austin Fitz? My dear friend, former Assistant Secretary of Housing, past Managing Director of Dillon Reed, the Wall Street Investment Bank, and the founder of the website Solari, S-O-L-A-R-I.com. We have documented from government records that, 1 year the Department of Defense lost $2.1 trillion of your money. $2.1 trillion. Another year they lost $1.1 trillion. HUD lost $59 billion. They made an adjustment to their checkbook, that's all they did, to fix it. They didn't try to go look for it. That money is being moved offshore, it's being taken out of the country, and it's also being used now to buy U.S. Treasury bills because the rest of the world is dumping the dollar to keep this economy sustained so people like you will keep buying stocks and keep consuming. They're suckering you to take the fall. Get ready for it. China is not only consuming most of the world's commodities, it is stockpiling and hoarding them. In 2004, they bought and consumed half of the world's cement, interfering with U.S. construction projects. In 2004, China purchased twice as much copper as the rest of the world combined. In 2004, China purchased almost one-third of the world's coal and is currently experiencing shortages. In 2004, China purchased 90% of the world's steel output. China is currently holding $1.9 trillion in U.S. currency and T-bills. Now, let's stop there for a second. You guys can think. 70% of all transportation is fueled by oil. Why would China be hoarding all these commodities now when oil is $53 a barrel? So they won't have to pay $105 a barrel to ship this really heavy shit to China when oil costs four times as much as it does now. Make sense? The Chinese know and believe in peak oil. They get it, clearly. When China floats their currency, the yuan or the renminbi, the terms are interchangeable, it's not going to, it'll help the U.S. budget deficit, it'll hurt you like you can't believe. Everything you buy at Walmart or anywhere that's made in China is going to go up by however much the yuan appreciates, 40% immediately. It's going to hurt investments. It's going to weaken the dollar. But the Senate and the Treasury and the White House are pressuring China to float their currency as soon as possible. That will signal the end of the U.S. economy as you know it. That and when several other things happen, including the housing bubble, which we'll talk about, and several other major crises that are all looking to happen like all at once. Gold will probably hit $600 an ounce. Within a year from that time, it could reach $1,000 an ounce. I am a great fan of physical gold. A lot of people don't understand gold. Gold as a metal, as an element, is non-reactive. It doesn't change. It doesn't react with anything. It is a measurable standard, which is as absolute, if you will, as a thermometer or as a yardstick. You can measure it. You can trust it. And anybody can measure an ounce of gold and know what it is and test it. It's been the single most respected store or measure of value or wealth in human history. A funny thing about gold, it's not currency. You can buy gold at any gold coin store anywhere. I have a bunch of links on my website. I get no special financial advantages for recommending gold, but it's the only investment that I make. Physical gold, gold that I hold in my hand. Because as the currencies collapse, gold will hold its value and become more valuable. It's been artificially suppressed for decades because on the financial markets, when the gold prices rise, that means the financial markets are in trouble. So the central banks have conspired to keep the price of gold down, but everybody who knows about gold knows that the price has been rising much faster than the stock market has for some time now. And it's a funny thing, if you travel overseas, how many people have traveled overseas before? Fill out a customs form? It always asks, are you carrying more than $10,000 in U.S. currency? Gold is not currency. You can carry 15 pounds of gold and you don't have to declare it anywhere. Okay. I'm a fan of gold, and you watch what gold does. Now, again, I make predictions, and people call me up a week later and say, well, what you said didn't happen. I said, it's only been a week, for Christ's sake. You know? But there's five times more physical gold, more paper gold than there is actual gold out of the ground. Do not buy gold futures, gold options, gold hedge, but don't. Some gold mining stocks might be good, but physical gold, I'm talking Canadian maple leaves, Swiss francs, Krugerrands, whatever, and you hold it. You hold it. You don't have to ask anybody here. Anybody here survived the Great Depression? There's probably nobody that old, but my grandparents did. You know, and people around the world, whenever the poop hit the fan, gold is where they went. And I strongly recommend that you think about that. You don't have to be rich to buy gold. Buy little pieces. Peak oil production has already hit every nation in the world except Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia. But Saudi Arabia, we know now, I should redo this. I think Saudi Arabia has peaked, and there's very compelling evidence that it has. We will talk about that. Saudi Arabia contains 25% of the known oil reserves on the planet. 25%. If Saudi Arabia has peaked, planet Earth has peaked. Axiomatic. It's simple mathematics. You cannot get away from that. The single largest oil field in the world is Ghawar, G-H-A-W-A-R, in Saudi Arabia, which when discovered was estimated to hold about 90 billion barrels. And there's very compelling evidence that Ghawar has peaked. We'll come to that later. So that's a very strong sign that we are at the moment of crisis right now. Crude oil prices have doubled since 9/11. That's a clue. A lot of people are aware of peak oil. A lot of people outside the U.S. are very aware. In Great Britain especially, where 50,000 people every winter freeze to death because there's not enough energy. You didn't know about that, did you? In Britain, they classify these as excess deaths. They don't say, old people, they call them pensioners in Great Britain, actually have radiators that dispense heat that you can put coins into. So every day they make a decision between eating and putting coins in the radiator to stay warm. And of course, as the price of energy goes up, it's a choice between would I rather freeze to death or starve to death. Much of the world is going to be making decisions like this soon. But this is a recent BBC poll. I'm sorry, it's so small. It's best we could get the screen. The BBC asked viewers what they wanted BBC to cover. Let me see. Stories from Iraq, climate change, well, that was 7.8%. Climate change, 16.12%. Peak oil, 32.16%. The UN, primate research, Africa, 6%, 9%. Peak oil, far and away. BBC viewer summary. That's what they want to know about in Great Britain, but you aren't hearing about it here, are you? because there's an enormous government disinformation campaign out there that is unfortunately affecting some really gullible people. Say, oh, there's plenty of oil, it's really an ulterior plan, we're going to be fine, we're trying to drive Saudi Arabia, make them use their oil first because we've got five times as much. Yeah, if that's the case, then why the hell is GM ready to go bankrupt? And why is Ford ready to go bankrupt? Both of their bonds have been downgraded to junk status. When were they thinking about springing this stuff? BBC News, gloom gathers over world economy. Okay, let's talk about a fundamental principle of economics here. For the past 50, 60 years, there has been like a 96% correlation between economic growth, or GDP growth, or GNP growth, 96% correlation between economic growth and greenhouse gas emission. Isn't that like self-evident? If you're going to grow the economy, that means you might open a business, and if you open a business and somebody's got to drive trucks to your business to build it, you got to wire it for electricity, you got to have phones and computers, people got to drive to you, you got to have products shipped in, you burn greenhouse, that's how you grow the economy. But the world economy, the world economic paradigm, is based upon fiat currency, basically the United States dollar, but most other currencies are fiat currency. Fractional reserve banking, where a bank can lend between $9 and $15 depending upon their reserve requirements, based upon how many dollars they have on deposit, and debt-based growth. You borrow money to grow. That economic paradigm requires infinite growth. Every year, the companies that trade their stock on Wall Street have to report growth or their stocks collapse and the CEOs get fired. Now, how many people here believe that economic growth is possible unto infinity? Good, no hands there. All right. Well, we know that economic growth is connected to energy usage. How many people believe that energy is infinite? Okay, well, you want to talk about the laws of thermodynamics, we'll do it. Okay, but in the world we live in, energy is not infinite. Okay, but that doesn't do anything to run your car because there's no infrastructure to change it. I'm not talking theory, I'm talking practical life and death stuff right now.
Agreed.
Okay, thank you. First law of thermodynamics says energy can neither be created nor destroyed. It can't. But the second law says energy converts in one direction only, from usable to unusable. It's the law of entropy. It never converts backwards. There is no free lunch. There is no perpetual motion. So, the requirement for infinite economic growth, going up the curve like this in the graph, has just collided with finite energy. And we get now world-renowned people, Matthew Simmons, the world's largest energy investment banker, who I have really ambivalent feelings about. He's been very forthright about peak oil, but his clients include Kerr McGee, the World Bank, and Halliburton, so he's a fairly big dude. He's a member of CFR, not my favorite group of people, but I've met Matt several times. He and I used to be friends until he read Crossing the Rubicon. He was kind of cold to me in Edinburgh, Scotland, just a couple of months ago. That's the first time I'd seen him since Rubicon came out. But he has said clearly, economic growth is no longer possible. Okay, but we haven't changed the way money works, so what happens with the financial markets? How many people here have a pension fund?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, what's your pension fund? And it's mutual funds, right? Which is stocks. I mean, you know, didn't we see in the 2001-2002 crashes, pension funds get wiped out across the board? Pension funds are all based on the same economic paradigm. Future economic growth is not going to be possible, except unless we start killing people or making other people pay with their lives to, for the very short term, keep this illusion going. Gas prices going up, up, up. Experts predict $3 a gallon. The San Francisco Chronicle has been doing some great stories lately on peak oil. It's starting to hit now in the mainstream media all over the world. IMF warns of permanent oil shock. Oh boy, Now, if like there's two people who pretend to be your friends and they say, hi, we're your friends, one's the IMF and the World Bank, you run and you cover your private parts, you lock up your children, you put your wallet away because, you know, when they start talking, IMF warns on risk of permanent oil shock. This is not in the interest of those people unless, and we're going to talk about some of those contingencies. But this stuff is now coming out. 2-3 years ago, nobody would talk about this. The Christian Science Monitor is an excellent newspaper. They're very widely, highly regarded and respected for their ethics and for their journalistic integrity. Inevitable oil squeeze draws near. This is from April 21. All these are from the last 30, 60 days. Global race is on to snag oil supplies. When I stood on the stage at Portland State University here on November 28, 2001, I said, what we are witnessing as a result of 9/11, for which the United States government had complicity, is a race by the United States to secure and control the last remaining oil reserves on the planet. For that, the nation called me a conspiracy theory, published stories saying that I was a mental case. For that, a whole bunch of people on what I call the lily-livered left came out and said I was an idiot, insane, a fascist, a racist. But I was right. What I have found over the last four years, roughly since 9/11, is that nobody has had the courage to attack my research. They attack me personally, and that's the same. It's not just me. It's all of us. Mark knows all of the great 9/11, the really solid 9/11 researchers, and those of you who have read Crossing the Rubicon know that I pay homage to about 30 or 40 incredible people in that book who have contributed so much to our knowledge. Beware when you hear the personal ad hominem attacks, because if somebody can't take on somebody else's research, that means they're in trouble. But now you see the same thing that I said 3.5 years ago. That's what's on right now. That's what 9/11. Now, this is kind of interesting. How many people have ever heard of the IEA? Not many. International Energy Agency. It's a arm of the UN, created by treaty. The G7 nations are signatories to this treaty. And in the event of a global energy emergency, the IEA has the ability to override in any country it chooses to, the national laws. The IEA, if it declares an emergency, could, in the United States, order mandatory rationing, limit driving to odd-numbered license plates one day, even license plates the next day, impose mandatory restrictions on consumption, driving, rationing, you name it, they can do it. They have announced, it has been announced, that they're dusting off these plans and they're working on emergency contingency plans for this right now. Right now. Financial Times, here it is again. Financial Times is also, it's a paper out of England, a very prestigious economic paper. You find a lot of gems in there. IEA to call for an emergency oil plan. This is just from March 28th of 2005. This is all just recent developments right now that are being dusted off. Al Jazeera, U.S. report acknowledges peak oil threat. Isn't it interesting that you didn't hear about it from any American media, but Al Jazeera has to report it? Now, Al Jazeera, for those of you who don't know, is not that damn Arab network. Al Jazeera has a viewing audience, their TV viewing audience, of around 250 million people. Al Jazeera is barred from operating or broadcasting inside Saudi Arabia. Saudi government won't let Al Jazeera into the country. This fall, on the fourth anniversary of September 11th, Al Jazeera will be airing a four-hour special series on September the 11th. Yours truly is in two of the 4 hours, and I'm in the end credits for every episode, and I'm also in all the commercials, which means I'll probably be shot before it airs. But they're using a lot of the research from Rubicon for that. And Al Jazeera is doing some great work. The guy who wrote this story, by the way, is a guy by the name of Adam Porter. Adam Porter is not a very Arab-sounding name, is it? Arab is a British guy from Manchester, Liverpool, who is probably the premier peak oil reporter on the planet, in my humble opinion. Adam's a dear friend, and he's everywhere. And Al Jazeera is telling the truth. So you can go to the Al Jazeera website to find out what's going on. And they talk about this report, just recently released. It's called Peaking of World Oil Production Impacts, Mitigation, and Risk Management by Robert L. Hirsch, SAIC, project leader. How many people have ever heard of the company SAIC? Science Applications International Corporation. That is one of the deepest, biggest, scariest, high-tech, spooky computers, CIA, NSA, in your back door, in your computer, in your face, spies, suppressed civil liberties corporations you could ever hear of. Not only that, they're not nice guys. Okay, Admiral Bobby Ray Inman, former head of Defense Intelligence Agency, is on their board. They got more spies and bad guys and spooks and crooks and SAIC. They also very heavily involved in the policing and control of the internet, by the way. This is their report released in February of 2005, and here's a great quote from that report. Al Jazeera caught this. The authors of the report also dismissed the power of the markets to solve any oil peak. They call for the intervention of governments, but also they rather worryingly point to a need to exclude public debate and environmental concerns from the process. They say this is needed to speed up decision making. What? They don't want you talking about peak oil. They don't want you knowing about it so that they can make better decisions about what to do with your life. Yeah? Now, first sentence is very critical, though. The authors of the report also dismissed the power of the markets to solve any oil peak. You hear opponents or the critics of peak oil, the guys who are trying to keep the stock market bubble afloat, stocks afloat, and trying to keep you ill-informed about what's going on, will argue that science and technology will solve everything. The Stone Age didn't end because the world ran out of stones. It ended because we found better things to do. Iron. Okay, well, that is totally fallacious reasoning. We call these people the flat earth economists who believe that by throwing money at any problem, you can find a solution. I would submit to you that if I lock any one of you up in the bank of the Federal, in the vault of the Federal Reserve Bank in New York City, with tens of billions of dollars in cash, no matter how hard you tried, you could not materialize a hot dog. Think about it. San Francisco Chronicle again. Chevron Texaco CEO banking on peak oil situation. Uh-oh. When the big corporations start putting their money that it's going to go that way, you really got something to worry about. And what they said clearly was Chevron's Texaco's chief executive officer, Dave O'Reilly, has just spent $16 billion to buy Unocal. Why? Because oil companies know there's no more oil to find. The only way they can increase their reserves is by eating other oil companies. But what this story didn't tell you, maybe it did way down in the back, this is a story from April of 2005, is that in December of 2004, China offered $13.9 billion to buy Unocal. China buying Unocal? This says clearly that Chevron Texaco CEO knows there ain't no more oil to find. Unocal has some leases in the Southwest Pacific, but the point is Unocal has reserves. And he put all that cash up. And here's another one. And this is purposely very small because this is from an ExxonMobil corporate report. And this is about the size they printed it in the report. Isn't that cute? They didn't want you to read this. I need a magnifying glass.
Exxon joins the teams without any press conferences, grand announcements, or hyperbolic advertising campaigns. The ExxonMobil Corporation, one of the world's largest publicly owned petroleum companies, has quietly joined the ranks of those who are predicting an impending plateau in non-OPEC oil production. Their report, The Outlook for Energy, a 2030 view, forecasts a peak in just 5 years.
They're lying. They had to say 5 years because the markets would crash if they said it was now.
Alfred J. Cavallo Bolton of the Atomic Scientists. And I did that because that's how big Exxon actually put it in their report. You really had to look to find it. But it's there.
FinancialTimes.com. World's thirst for oil makes falling output worse. Why? Until you change the way money works, you can change nothing. Here's where we are right now, tracked. Now, you would think that given the circumstances, a rational, sane world, knowing that peak was imminent, governments and economies would start to implement conservation measures, right? Okay, but what happens now? Anytime there's a little let-up in supply, in other words, there's a little excess surplus supply, it's only encouraging more oil use. Why? Because all the countries around the world, or the United States, have to show economic growth. If they have more oil supply, they reduce the oil prices a little bit, so people use more to grow the economy more, so they have more dollars to buy more oil.